This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Hip-hop music was born in America, but now belongs to the world. Its global reach and influence is undeniable. So how did it happen that a DIY movement born in the Bronx came to have such an impact on international culture? Patrick Douthit can tell you. He's better known as Ninth Wonder, a Grammy Award-winning record producer based in Durham, who not only makes music, but has always taken a deep interest in its history and influence. For the next month, Ninth Wonder is going to do a lecture series that puts hip-hop in context. He's going to look at pivotal moments in the music and how it can be a cultural encyclopedia for listeners today. The lecture series starts tonight at the Hunt Library on NC State's campus in Raleigh. It'll continue through the end of July. Ninth Wonder's been an artist in residence at NC Central University, a hip-hop fellow at Harvard University, and is currently an adjunct professor at Duke. Ninth Wonder joins me in the studio now. Welcome back. Good to have you back.
How you doing, old friend?
It is so great to see you. So tell us about this course now. Why put this in context? Why is this important for you?
Very important, because I've always been a stickler for wanting people to understand more about what they see on the surface. And I think hip-hop has been it's an art form that's been misconstrued, misinterpreted, misunderstood. So I've always wanted for people to see more there than what it is, because I believe people want to know more. Some people accept things for what they are, and that's it, and you know, they're fine with that. But for the people that want to know more about the culture, because it affects the way it affects kids, it affects how we educate kids. You know, I'm 40 years old, so we're like the first hip-hop generation. Right. So, you know, it's a totally different language that a lot of people sometimes can't understand and can't. So I just want to make sure people, you know, understand it more.
Well, you know, that affectionate greeting of yours is well earned, because we go back 15 years, 2001, when Little Brother was on this show.
Right.
And we were far away. And even then, it amazed me and it struck me what a geek you were for the history and the context. I mean, you really cared about where this stuff came from and why it's important to understand it as a cultural phenomenon more than just as a commercial success.
You know, blame all those world book encyclopedias that my mom and dad had in the house. But, you know, just I've been a history major for a long time.
Yeah.
Historian for a long time, and you know, it just so happens that I has had the chance to meld the two, history of music and just history in general, because I totally believe that, you know, a lot of the great social movements that we've had in the 20th century has been charged by a musical revolution behind it. It's always had a soundtrack, and you know, that's where I've always been. So I've become this nerd, if you will.
You are. Where do you start your series? But I, you know, as a producer on Destiny's Child, you know, when a Grammy Award winner, one who has earned his chops and earned the reputation as not only a historian but also as a musician and one who makes the music quite successfully. So tell us where you start your series.
I start my series on, you know, getting into the history of the importance of being able to talk in rhyme, speak in rhyme, and have a responsibility with it. I think that's been separated over the years. Mm-hmm. Some people talk in rhyme, speak in rhyme, and don't think it's a responsibility that comes with it. Mm-hmm. Anytime you get in front of a microphone, as you know, has a responsibility. But I start in, you know, in West Africa, and we talk about griots and truth speakers and truth sayers and bar traditions, and we take it all the way until, you know, early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a long time and a long way to travel.
Pivotal moment comes at the civil rights movement, which is the intersection of, again, a social activist movement and a revolution, we could say, in music, where R&B
right.
is now making it into the pop charts and hitting number one
right.
on the Billboard charts.
Well, I think, you know, civil rights, the thing about civil rights, when people say civil rights, they automatically think black. And I think, you know, it's in the 60s, you had the Black People's Civil Rights Movement, you had the Poor White People's Movement, you had the Puerto Rican Nationalist Movement. Mm-hmm. You had so many movements of oppressed people. Oppressed does not only mean one color or one attire, you know, people. Sometimes it's monetary, sometimes it's social, economic. So, you know, it starts there. And anytime anything is oppressed, it definitely people get creative, man.
Well, it's also a global movement. I mean, this is the anti-colonial movement. This is a time in which people are liberating themselves from an oppressive structure, which, you know, was more or less successful in that moment. But let's talk about the music, too, and let's talk about some of the R&B hits at the time. You used the song Baby Love from the Supremes. I want to get a little clip and make it fresh in our ear and then ask you why this is an important song in the history of hip-hop. There it is, 1964 song Baby Love, The Supremes, and my guest is Durham-based music producer Ninth Wonder, who's teaching a lecture series on hip-hop at NC State tonight. Where does that fit in the history of hip-hop?
Well, you know, that song is very instrumental in the making of me for my parents.
I see.
They were kids of Motown. They were, you know, fans of Motown. But most importantly, you know, Berry Gordy was and is the architect of the music that we make. I think, you know, the Puff Daddies of the world and all of the great CEOs when it came to hip-hop labels and such patterned themselves after Berry Gordy and Motown and Hitsville. So that's kind of the genesis of where we will, you know, putting out popular music in a sense for us.
And famously, I mean, Berry Gordy wanted about as much distance between him and the civil rights movement as he could possibly
put, right?
Right,
of course.
So
he said his music was for everybody.
His music was for everybody, and he did that, and that was what happened. And so you also say 1960s is a pivotal time in the Bronx because this is when gentrification begins in the Bronx.
Right. Robert Moses created Cross Bronx Expressway, which, you know, sometimes when I lecture, I talk about the Durham Freeway. It's the same thing when it went straight through Black Wall Street. You know, sometimes it helps. It does help transportation, but at the same time, it can tear up a neighborhood. And so it tearing up a neighborhood in the Bronx, you know, made those people want to do something else. It created gangs. It created, you know, allegiances and alliances. But at the same time, it created people or different cultures to be able to talk to each other through the music, which music and mathematics are the two universal languages, but music, you know, is the one that you can make a friend off first. And so that's what happened in the Bronx in 1965, 1966, going all the way up into the mid-70s, that people were talking to each other through the music, although their neighborhood was dilapidated.
Was it insulated? I mean, how much of this was becoming, sort of making its way, you know, onto the airwaves?
You know, it took a while. It took... You know, it was a long way between 1965 and 1979, 1980, when rap started to make its face on radio. You know, it was just something that you did in the neighborhood. It wasn't even called hip-hop yet. It was just called, you know, and talking to Crazy Legs, which is probably the most well-renowned b-boy in the world. You know, talking to him, he said, you know, we didn't call it hip-hop. We just called it something that, you know, you rhyme, oh, I rhyme, let's battle. That's what it was. You know, it was kind of a martial arts thing, if you will, right? So, but at the same time, you know, it still didn't get to the airwaves until like the early 80s, and that's being TV or radio.
But it became a real culture. I mean, these rhyme contests then drew an audience, and they became more and more elaborate, included dancing and music along with it, right?
Right. You know, that was the international appeal of it, which made, you know, the likes of Afrika Bambaataa and people like that, you know, go overseas to get with groups called, like, with Kraftwerk and find different sounds, and it just became this worldwide phenomenon overnight, like in the trenches.
Tell us about the breaks and then when sampling became possible.
You know, sampling became possible because, you know, New York public school systems in the 70s decided to cut back on arts programming, and, you know, taking away things from people. Like I said, you started to create things. So people would take records to find the best part of a song, which is called the break. And sometimes repeat it. Sometimes the break wasn't long enough. Sometimes the break was 5 seconds. Sometimes the break was 10 seconds. Take two records and put them together and keep repeating it back and forth. That was kind of the precursor of sampling. But sampling has always been a part of American culture, whether it be music or literature. Some books sampled other books.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just so happens that now the sampling was on records in the neighborhoods.
Shakespeare rarely wrote an original story.
Rarely.
those are stories everybody knew, and
right.
he just kind of redid it, and that's what made him great is his interpretation of that. And his
exactly.
audience was also key. He had a live audience of maybe 2,000 people a week. There's a lot of interplay between that kind of sampling. So
that's right.
it has a long history in many, many cultures. I want to play a clip now of Ashley's Roach clip, right? This is the Soul Searchers in 1974, and I want to see where this fits.
Right.
So there's a clip of the 1974 song Ashley's Roach Clip by the Soul Searchers, and my guest is Durham-based music producer Ninth Wonder, who's teaching a lecture series on hip-hop at NC State. So what's going on there?
That's, man, to be honest, there's three samples in that song. You know, some people listening to it will say, oh, that's Eric B. and Rakim Payton Fool, but it's also LL Cool J's Jack the Ripper, and it's also Run's House by Run DMC. Like, there's three, and there were three back-to-back. But those particular moments and songs is where dancers would come out and dance, and that's where break dancing came from, because they would dance with these short intermediate parts and songs. So, yeah, that's kind of like the genesis of what we do.
And it's interesting because at that moment in history, in the 70s, it's done mechanically, right? We're not talking about electronic sampling, or was it?
Right. It was done by hand. It
yeah.
was done by DJs. We're going to play the break with my right hand, and then we're going to come right behind it with my left hand with the same record. And just keep it going and going and going and going until some bright guy came along. Look, let's make some type of technology that we can just loop this stuff,
yeah.
you know. And his name was Roger Lynn.
But that also, I mean, that's part of the theater of it as well. I mean, watching this happen and knowing where these breaks come, being able to actually manipulate the machines, and it all becomes part of the larger culture. So let's play a clip now. You mentioned Eric B. and Rakim's now this is the 1987 song, right? And I don't think that was sampled in the song we just heard, because we're about to play a clip from Paid in Full.
Paid in Full.
All right, let's listen.
Thinking of a master plan. Cause ain't nothing but sweat inside my hand. So I dig into my pocket, all my money spent. So I get deeper, but still coming up for lint. So I start my mission, leave my residence. Thinking how could I get some dead presidents? I need money. I used to be a stick-up kid. So I think of all the devious things I did. I used to roll up. This is a hole-up. Ain't nothing funny. Stop smiling. You still don't nothing move but the money. But now I learn to earn cause I'm righteous. I feel great. So maybe I might just search for a 9-to-5. If I strive, then maybe I stay alive. So I walk up the street whistling this, feeling out of place, cause man, do I miss a pen and a paper, a stereo, a taper, me and Eric being a nice big plate of fish, which is my favorite dish, but without no money, it's still a wish, cause I don't like to dream about getting paid, so I dig into the books of the rhymes that I made, so now it's a test to see if I got pulled. Hit the studio, cause I'm paid in full.
That's a song produced in 1987 called Paid in Full. So what, you know, in terms of dancing, I mean, obviously this is the best part. We want to keep that going over and over again. But what influence is it having on the culture and the music itself?
Well, if we're talking about this song, you know, Rakim, you know, we call in our you know, culture, we call Rakim. Rakim is like the Bob Dylan of hip-hop, you know, if you want anybody to understand. He's like the one of the holy grail pieces that we have in hip-hop, is because he introduced, you know, his rhyme style, and at the same time he introduced a different religion to hip-hop that we didn't even know. You know, a lot of us were Christians, and here comes Islam that we wasn't even, you know, introduced to as kids. But it's funny that this is the song that I broke down to my mother, because my mom started to say, well, son, you know, when I started making money off this thing, she said, well, son, you know, just explain to me what you do, because I don't know. You know what I mean? You know, I bought you these CDs and I bought you these albums, but I still don't know. So I used this song and the message in this song to break it down to my mother, like, you know, mom, he says, thinking of a master plan, because ain't nothing but sweat inside my hand. Ain't that your story? Ain't that the story of a working class American? Like, you know what I mean? That's how he starts this song. The song is about him talking about, instead of me going out doing something wrong, now I learn to earn because I'm righteous. I feel great. So maybe I might just search for a 9-to-5. If I strive, then maybe I'll stay alive. That's the song of a lot of people, no matter if you like hip hop or not.
Did this music then speak to a younger generation when it was sort of in the early 80s when it starts?
It definitely did, because not only, you know, the MTV 80s were a time where now you're starting to see what the artists look like. You know, in the 70s, sometimes you didn't get a chance to see. You know, I read an interview on Christopher Cross, which is one of my favorite artists, and he said, you know, at the time, I can just put a pink flamingo on the cover of my album and I'm good and call it sailing. He said once MTV came, it was like, oh man. And that's when the whole idea of video killed the radio star, because now you start to see exactly what people look like. But Rakim looked cool to us. He had a gold chain on. He had the, you know, the latest sneakers, you know, but he also had a message. And so that's why it looked cool to us, as opposed to like being 13 and listening to the Temptations. That didn't look cool to us. Right.
But there was message. I mean, what was their message? Because this, we're coming out of the Black Nationalist movement of the 1970s, so there's a lot of message happening in the air, maybe not through popular music, though.
Right. Everything runs in 20-year intervals. Like, you know, Public Enemy came right on time because Public Enemy was talking about things that we weren't exposed to in the late 1960s and early 1970s. We were hearing names that we hadn't ever heard before in school. We were hearing Fred Hampton and all of these people that Chuck D was talking about in his songs. And so it was introduced to us in a different way. The Black Nationalist Movement was introduced to a bunch of 14-year-olds, 15-year-olds on record now, as opposed to in-your-face, you know, governmental stuff. It was just introduced a different way.
Well, but it's not to say it wasn't happening in popular music in the 1970s. I mean, here's James Brown with the Payback, 73.
Payback!
James Brown, 1973, The Payback, and there's a message there.
Absolutely. You know, he had that. He had Say It Loud, I'm Black, I'm Proud. You know, James had a message two different ways. He had, of course, he had a Black Nationalist message and became the soundtrack for that. But he also had a message of music independence, how to be able to control your own destiny. And when it comes to running your own label or having your own music or even having your own band or even driving your own sound. So it was kind of like the Big Payback had so many different definitions to it.
What about musically? I've got a little time in this segment to just think about there are some threads that run through this, but there does seem to be a kind of a break. What's the continuity and where's the break between what we would consider straight ahead R&B and what we now think of as hip hop?
I think the backdrop may be the same. You know, and using, that's the thing about in hip hop, we use breaks and samples from R&B acts. Right. So the chord change may be the same, the melodies may be the same when it comes to the backdrop, but I think what kind of breaks the generation was, we went from singing to like what older people would say, just random talking. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That kind of lost, you know, my parents. Yeah. It's like, what are they saying? They're saying things with no tone to their voice, which you know, it's a big argument with a lot of, you know, present day rock stars or even rock legends, and saying that hip hop is not music because there's no tonality in what they're saying. Although the music may say something different, the backdrop may say something different, but it joins together by using samples. You know, I say all the time, when some people ask when I sample, I say, you know, I took a band from the 70s, I sampled the band, a rapper raps on the band, a rapper performs it live, and have a band play over what I sampled. So that's a circle.
And there was a lot of music and creativity in that. We're going to continue our conversation about the history of hip-hop with Ninth Wonder on The State of Things in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking with producer Ninth Wonder, who's presenting a lecture series next month, for the next month, I should say. It begins tonight. It puts hip-hop in context, starts tonight at the Hunt Library at NC State University in Raleigh. We've been talking about the history. We've got the whole timeline and some videos at our website, stateofthings.org. I want to talk about, again, some of the sampling and it reaching back into the 70s and pulling it forward into the 80s. Let's play a clip right now from the 1973 song Apache by the Incredible Bongo Band. This is the 73 version. There's Apache making the charts in 1973 by the Incredible Bongo Band. Let's hear now from the Sugar Hill Gang version, and this takes us into the 1980s. Clip of the 1981 song Apache by the Sugar Hill Gang, and I'm talking to Ninth Wonder, Durham-based record producer. So what's the significance of that? What's happening now? And this is 1981 now.
Okay, the second one, the 1981 version is the, like, that's the party starting song. Every time
did
I play
Sugar,
that
song. Did Sugar Hill Gang, I mean, they're sort of credited with starting hip-hop. I mean, can you, it's hard to put a start point on this, right?
They're credited with having one of the first records. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in hip hop, they're credited with being, you know, like I say, one of the first records or having the first, okay, here it is. This is what it is. This is how we're selling it. This is how we can put this in a space where we can actually sell this thing. You know, but at the same time, the 1973 version of Apache begs the idea of the way it sounds with the bongos and the drums. What kind of, like, melting pot the Bronx was. Like, you know, 1965 came the Immigration Act of 1965, and that just opened the floodgates to the United States. 70% of immigrants were allowed to come in the United States, and this is by Lyndon Baines Johnson. But at the same time, a lot of those immigrants came to the Bronx and New York City, or just New York City in general, mainly the Bronx. And like I said, music became the language to talk to people. To each other, and now you have different ethnic backgrounds getting together and making music together, which that's why the Incredible Bongo Band sounds the way it sounds, which gives us the 1981 version of it. But Sugar Hill Gang was like one of the first groups to have a record, and this, we're going to sell this now. Whatever this is, whatever, okay, we'll call it hip-hop, we're going to sell it.
Forgive me for not knowing this. The Incredible Bongo Band, was that a Bronx band? Were they from there, or do you know?
I'm not sure. Yeah. You know, it might have been some kids from the Bronx. It might have been kids from all over New York that met in the Bronx. You know, the Bronx is credited for actually being the breeding ground and starting for what we now know as hip-hop.
We think about it in terms of music, and of course that's really the face of hip-hop, but it's a lot more than that. It's dance, it's style, it's fashion, and I mean, graffiti plays a part in this, right?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, before gentrification, you know, 1965 in the Bronx, 1964, the Bronx was a bustling metropolis of art and culture, right? But after, you know, after the highway was built, it turned into something else. But it didn't stop people from being creative. They just became more creative, and they just came from different areas and backgrounds.
Tell us about the message and its importance in the hip-hop scene.
The Message was the first song that's considered, as a lot of people would say, conscious. Some people, you know, hip-hop is divided from, you know, the quote-unquote more commercial-sounding songs that you just dance to messages that are considered conscious. And The Message was a song that had, okay, we're not partying, we're not having a good time, as opposed to Rapper's Delight was, we're in the club, we're having a good time, it looks like Studio 54. The Message was like, you know, broken glass everywhere. Like, that was, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. Like, that was like the, no, things are not great in the Bronx, and this is what it looks like and sounds like. So,
Grandmaster Flash, it's 1982, it's called The Message.
My son said, Daddy, I don't want to go to school because the teacher's a jerk. He must think I'm a fool and all the kids smoke reefer. I think it'd be cheaper if I just got a job, learn to be a street sweeper. I dance to the beat, shuffle my feet, wear a shirt and tie and run with the creeps because it's all about money. Ain't a damn thing funny. You got to have a con in this land of milk and honey. They pushed that girl in front of the train, took her to the doctor, sewed her arm on the game. Stabbed that man right in his heart. Gave him a transplant for a brand new start. I can't walk through the park cause it's crazy after dark. Keep my hand on my gun cause they got me on the run. I feel like an outlaw, broke my last glass jaw. Hear them say, you want some more? Living on a seesaw. Don't push me cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. Say what? It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Like a jungle sometimes, it makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
That's a clip from the 1982 song The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. My guest is Durham-based music producer and Grammy Award winner Ninth Wonder, teaching a lecture series on hip-hop at NC State beginning tonight. So there it is. And you say this is the beginning of the sort of the overt and sort of mindful and intentional kind of message.
Right. I mean, you know, The Message as a song wasn't too far from country music at the time. My dog just died. My wife left me. I'm doing bad. I don't have a job. I'm drunk. Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of
no.
Like,
I mean, there's an old blues song about a dog losing his tail on the railroad track, and you know how that one goes. And that's the first thing I thought. But then this is so much more power. This is like a young, you know, it really brings it. But it does remind me of that. So it calls to mind that blues song, and then the powerful stark imagery and the pain that he's reflecting, again resurrecting an older sound is. By bringing those two, that history together, gives it a kind of a scope and depth that you don't have otherwise.
Right. It's just, you know, it gave the music a chance to expose the underbelly of America. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us don't live in the same places, raised in the same places. And they used hip-hop to talk about those things that a lot of people don't want to talk about. And so that's what The Message came from. Like, it's just a song of straight despair, although it also became a party song because of the beat to it. Right.
Well, and the despair increases in the 1980s. This is the Reagan era. It is not a good time for people of color and not a good time for people in distressed neighborhoods. And the war on drugs also begins in earnest in the 1980s. What impact does that have on the music?
You know, it has a big impact on the music because, you know, as Questlove of the Roots always says, you know, the best music is made when a Republican is in office. And I'm like, what? When I thought about it,
yeah,
you know, just from the standpoint of, you know, some people feel oppressed. A lot of people feel oppressed, you know, especially if you make a certain amount of money or don't make a certain amount of money. So the thing about it is like when people have their backs against the wall, no matter if it's dealing with politics or money or whatever it is, that's when you start to see the metal of a person. And that's when you start to get the best out of a person because now it's an art of survival, you know. And the music and the subject matter changes at that particular point.
And it brings us to N.W.A. or Public Enemy. Let's play Public Enemy song, Fight the Power.
What we need, hey. Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight.
Now we're up to 1989, Public Enemy, Fight the Power. We're going more from, we're taking it up another level, right? We're not just reflecting what's going on here. This is a call to action.
Right. This is a call to action for a generation of kids that wasn't exposed to it. You know, that was kind of, you know, the Black Nationalist Movement, you know, all the movements in the 1960s and 70s, whether we're talking about Black Nationalists or we're talking about Haight-Ashbury, no matter what, were kind of buried when it got to the 80s. And if you were a kid raised in the 80s, 13, 14 years old, you weren't around for that time. So Public Enemy and a lot of rock groups at the time were like,
right. Okay. Well, this is the rise of punk too. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. This is what revolution sounds like, but this is our version of it. So if I'm 14 years old and I'm born and raised in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, my first revolutionary piece of anything was Public Enemy, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back. And to give that to a 13-year-old, it lights a fire. And you know, whether if you that fire means to you want to read more or want to know more about yourself and where you come from, then Public Enemy was it.
It also ignited a controversy. This is when the music starts to make headlines and not just the Billboard Top 40.
Exactly. You know, anytime, you know, music causes revolution or causes people to think, then that's going to cause a stir somewhere else. And that's exactly what happened. It happened more with NWA, but it also happened with Public Enemy. They weren't the only people, you know, NWA wasn't the only people to receive FBI letters. Like, there were a lot of people at the time saying, hey, you know, you're talking a little bit too much. And again, I don't think it's only, that's not a hip hop thing. That's with anybody that has a voice that causes people to think.
What about, are there two strands at this time? Is there a kind of a division? I'm thinking about the Native Tongues Posse, groups like Tribe Called Quest and De La Soul, who had a slightly different message, although, again, a call to consciousness. Do you see this as a kind of a division in the music or just, you know, sort of different streams?
No, because, you know, NWA's, the album that people talk about that was kind of like a plant or kind of like, you know, I won't say kind of, but like an overt, you know, this is this in your face, this is negative gangster rap was E-File for Zaggin, which said something totally backwards if I said it the other way. So that particular album is, the drums off that album is what inspired Q-Tip of A Tribe Called Quest to give us a low-end theory, which a lot of people don't know. So,
well, tell us what Low End Theory is.
Low End Theory was the second studio release album from A Tribe Called Quest, which had the same, had a lot of pointed message on it. It had a message on it about date rape. It had a message on it, a lot of messages. But the soundscape of the second NWA album made Q-Tip want us, you know, the first Tribe album didn't sound as hard in the bottom as far as drums as the second one did. But it was Q-Tip's love for the NWA sound that made him want to make the studio album Low End Theory. And so, you know, Tribe was that group that made me say, hey, you know, it came along in the time that came around the Spike Lee era, the Different World, Dwayne Wayne era, you know, it made me say, hey, you know, I don't necessarily want to go out and pick up a picket, you know, get on a picket line and rush through a building with a gun, Public Enemy, but I do want to think. Yeah. And Tribe was like, yeah, this is what that Tribe fit me more, because they wanted me to think and they wanted me to be smart and they wanted me to go to school and wanted me to learn how to talk to women. And that was A Tribe Called Quest. That was the Native Tongues period.
And this is, we're going to play a clip from the album Midnight Marauders called Award Tour. Let's listen.
People give you air, so I be sublime. It's enjoyable to know you and the concubines. Take off your coats, ladies act like gems. Sit down, Indian styles, you recite these hymns. See, lyrically, I'm Mario Andretti on the Momo. Ludicrously speedy or infectious with the slow-mo. Heard me in the 80s, JB's on the promo. Am I never in the quest to get the paper on the caper? But now, let me take it to the queen side. I'm taking it to Brooklyn side. All the residential questers who invade the air. Hold up a second, son, cause we almost there. You could be a black man and lose all your soul. You could be white and blue, but don't prep the road. See, my is universal if you got knowledge of Dolo or Delta self. See, there's no one else who could drop it on the angle. Acute at that. So, who that, do that, do that, that, that. Come on. Who that, do that, do that, that, that.
That's a clip from the 1993 song Award Tour by A Tribe Called Quest. I'm talking to Ninth Wonder today, so we can hear jazz in there, hip-hop beats, and again, the message in the lyrics.
You know, jazz was a form of music that if you were raised in a Christian home, in a Christian household, and your mom and dad, like my mom and dad, listened to like James Cleveland and Mighty Clouds of Joy and Andre Crouch all the time. You know, Thelonious Monk was not on that playlist. it just wasn't.
Right.
You know, jazz for a long time to certain people was looked at as, you know, the devil's music or a mm-hmm. secular type of music.
Right.
You know, we're talking like Miles Davis, Count the Blue, and Cannonball Adderley, and, you know, Herbie Mann. You know, we can do it all day with jazz artists, but it just wasn't a favorite with certain parents,
yeah.
especially not my parents. But A Tribe Called Quest was the group that introduced me to it. You know, Spike Lee did it first because he put it in, you know, his dad, Bill Lee, was scoring, you know, School Days and Do the Right Thing and using jazz. But Tribe is what incorporated into hip hop for me. So I learned about a Cal Jader or a Ron Carter, or I learned about all these jazz greats because Q-Tip was sampling them.
It's amazing to think about this music that formed in a particular place in a particular time for particular reasons that has now become world music.
Right, right. You know, it's, you know, hip hop is a thing where I can go to France and DJ and I play every song in English and they know all of the words. But when it's time to ask me for an autograph, they can't ask me for an autograph because they don't know how to ask me in English. But, you know, that's just the universal appeal of a hip hop song. They're saying the words and they're saying them in rhyme. They might not even know what the words mean per se, but the rhyme and the rhythmic pattern of it is allowing them to say it. But by the time they come and ask me for the interview, they don't.
A lot of the words and a lot of the messages are resonating worldwide right now, and we can see evidence of that. Well, I'm always good to talk with you. Welcome back.
Thank you.
After 15 long years, and I said, I said, when you left it, the little brother, I said, I'm going to say, I knew you win. Now you got a Grammy, and you're doing all kinds of great things. Durham-based music producer, Ninth Wonder, teaching a lecture series on the history of hip-hop at NC State tonight. We've got the information at our website, plus a whole timeline, stateofthings.org. Got some videos up there and all the music as well. State of Things produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.